Hi.
Welcome.
Welcome back to Hell Money Podcast.
We have a very special guest for you today.
Yes.
It is Sid.
Sid rode his Harley all across America going to Bitcoin meetups in search of,
the American dream, the heart of America.
What's really going on?
True patriotism.
Yes, exactly. You
know, salt, really like engaging with the salt of the earth.
Yes.
Yes.
Started in Miami.
Searching for the soul of Bitcoin in America.
Exactly. And then ended in San Francisco last week at the meetup, which is where we met you. And I asked you to be on the podcast because I feel like you're getting at a lot of what this podcast is like trying to get at, which is like Bitcoin culture, meetup culture. Like, what are Bitcoiners actually about?
Real Bitcoin culture, not filtered through an algorithm.
Yes, not algorithmic Bitcoin culture that's designed to sort of polarize and enrage and make you click. But what are Bitcoiners actually like?
Yeah. And like, people who have like weird takes on the culture, right? Not necessarily who have the same standard ideas everybody else.
Yeah. What is Bitcoin? Oh, and also, what's Bitcoin culture outside of these sort of like major areas that you associate with Bitcoin, like San Francisco, Austin, et cetera? What are Bitcoiners like in the Midwest or, you know, East Coast, whatever?
And these are the people that we're going to need to rely on to resist when the government comes for our Bitcoin. And so I want to know, like, are they strong? Are they ready?
Yeah, you said Bitcoin outside of the major cities, which is kind of funny because on my trip, I found that the most energy and excitement for Bitcoin was outside of major cities.
Yeah.
Even just looking at a map of meetups, they're not all clustered. I mean, San Francisco has a lot. That's kind of the one outlier, but they're not really all clustered around these major cities. They're very spread out in kind of smaller second tier cities or whatever all over the country that, you know, 100 years ago might have been big manufacturing centers and now are kind of hollowed out.
That's
interesting.
But they
have this passion coming back.
Yeah. So what kind of cities, like which cities did you go to that you felt that sort of like vibrancy of Bitcoin culture that surprised you or just was,
Charlotte is a good example. Okay. Charlotte, North Carolina, Milwaukee, Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Hmm. These are places that I probably wouldn't have traveled to unless there was a Bitcoin meetup. But I went to the Bitcoin meetup and now I'm like, wow, I would come back here.
Really?
Yeah.
Nice.
How does the energy at the meetups in cities differ from the energy at smaller meetups?
So I'll characterize it in an example. I set up one meetup because my scheduling was bad in Chicago and four people showed up to the Chicago meetup.
Wow.
And I had more in Milwaukee. I had way more in Sioux Falls. I had way more all over the country at, at most meetups.
Mm.
And I kind of think back, I lived in Manhattan for 3 years and in a big city, there's so much going on all the time. People's attention is always competed for constantly. So to people in a big city, it feels more like Bitcoin is a part of their life and some interest that they have, but they're also doing 10 other things and they've got 10 friends that are inviting them to dinner. And you know, they have all this, these things going on in their lives. Whereas out in the country or in these smaller cities, Bitcoin makes up a bigger part of somebody's identity or somebody's interests.
Mm.
So to someone that lives in the middle of nowhere, to go to a Bitcoin meetup and meet other Bitcoiners is a much more exciting experience. Whereas if you live in a big city, like it's pretty easy to go out and find other people that are interested in other things that are somewhat similar to you. That's kind of my theory about it.
That's fair. I feel like I live in Oakland, not San Francisco, so not quite the like city center of the Bay Area. But for me, it was like hard to meet people with similar interests and sort of similar ways of seeing the world just because I didn't feel like I related to like a lot of people that live in San Francisco and just like kind of the perception that they have of like America. Especially I grew up in Pennsylvania and like kind of, you know, Pennsylvania's very purple state vibes. It's very like politically diverse and people have different ways of seeing things. It also is interesting to me that you said like, you know, sort of these cities that maybe had their heyday before and now are sort of like on the fall that you see Bitcoiners there. Cause that's what I see a lot in Pennsylvania is like people that moved there for manufacturing jobs and then that sort of went away. And now there's sort of this like absence of something. And
I can also see why those people would be into Bitcoin.
Exactly.
Because either these like X like market and industrial towns. Right. And Bitcoin is very much sort of in line with that ethos.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Milwaukee organizers talked a lot about how like one of
is
them is
Milwaukee a city or a state?
Casey.
What?
Gotta edit that.
Is
out.
It Milwaukee, Milwaukee? Maybe it's a city and a state?
It's no. Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Mm, okay.
It's on the coast of.
No, I have to keep that in. I need Casey looking like an idiot sometimes.
Just every once in a while, you really just love being something. Like,
I grew up in the Bay Area and I've never lived anywhere else. Anyway, so
one of the Milwaukee organizers is a software engineer. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about how in software, when somebody, you know, you can go to a really good school all over the country, a lot of good state schools, there's good schools in Wisconsin. But as soon as you get a degree, people flee to Chicago, they go to San Francisco, LA, mm-hmm. New York.
Yeah.
And that's where the good tech jobs are. Mm-hmm. And especially with the rise of remote work, why can't you work from Milwaukee? You
know, yeah.
But people don't want to come back there. So they're using Bitcoin as a way to try and attract more people to the state and mm-hmm. to kind of create some, even if it starts as just a kitschy, like, we're pro Bitcoin or whatever, we have Bitcoin companies here.
Right.
It starts with that and then it grows from there. But they're trying to bring people who are well educated, ambitious, back to the city to start growing industry and building things again.
Yeah, that's great.
Kind of as a way to do that.
That's great. I think that's been like a huge issue. I mean, it's probably in other countries too, but especially in the US, this like siphoning of talent away from smaller cities or rural areas or whatever, and sort of saying like, okay, well, if you want to make it, you should be willing to move wherever mm-hmm. and like start your life over right. and disconnect right. from your right. family and right. whatever.
Yeah.
I feel like that's been like a big reason why, you know, totally off topic at this point, but like why people are very hesitant to have kids is they don't have that support network around them.
They don't have that
if they're living
network.
In also, these cities that they've moved to for these jobs.
In these cities, insanely high cost of rent. And
totally.
One thing you need when you have kids is space. And so like, they're like, yeah, am I going to raise kids in this, like a studio apartment?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like the part of what attracted me to Bitcoin is like this, it feels like that sort of vibe that's being presented of, yeah, like as you said, these smaller cities that are sort of acknowledging like we need to attract people here. We want a vibrant community here, all those kind of things. Like that's the direction I think we should be heading. And I'm like, let's go.
Did you meet any like Bitcoin devs who were software engineers who were just out in the middle of nowhere? Like not out in the middle of nowhere, but you know, smaller town, you know, that they with a job that was remote somewhere else at, like in like a tech hub?
Yeah, here and there. Mm-hmm. I would find them working remote from
yeah.
you know, smaller cities.
They're probably just like killing it, right? Like they're like making like tech yeah, salaries.
Falling
out.
That's
the ultimate. Yeah. So I've been doing that arbitrage for 2.5 years, uh-huh. living in Southeast Asia and working for an American tech company.
Mm.
And I'm like, why have people not figured this out? Why are people not moving in droves and like balancing this out?
Yeah.
Because I was saving 80% of my salary.
Right, you know, right. Mm-hmm.
And living a better quality of life than I lived living in New York.
I don't know why people haven't figured it out, to be honest. Because I thought that with COVID and the remote work, because you've been working remotely since before COVID, right?
Yeah.
I thought that with remote work, there was going to be this sort of like rebalancing of people like moving for those sort of values, like wanting a better lifestyle, wanting more bang for their buck, wanting to live closer to whoever. And I feel like that's happened a little bit. I think even like you can sort of see the emergence of like Austin as becoming this big tech city is sort of a product of that. Like mm-hmm. people fleeing California and going to Austin, but it's not quite as like, I think that's one example. It's not quite as widespread as I thought it would be.
I heard that from more than a few Bitcoiners, people who left a large city and came kind of out in the country. I heard it from a lot of people just in terms of property values, like
yeah.
Western Colorado, for instance, used to be lots of free open, not free, but really low cost, big open land. Mm-hmm. And now it's a hot commodity. Mm. And from locals, they're saying that people are moving from Denver out because they want out of the big cities. After COVID, they realized maybe this isn't such a big benefit, so I'll go out. But it's making those places out in the middle of nowhere like a lot hotter.
Yeah.
Markets.
Yeah.
You know, a lot more people moving in.
Yeah. I feel like it's very situational because I think there's been a similar thing here with like Tahoe is another one that I think a lot of people like sort of fled to, moved mm-hmm. to, whatever. But yeah, I don't know. There is still this like disconnect I feel with like I guess city folk is the way to say it. Like with people who live in cities where I'm just like, what is going on here? Like, I feel like the writing on the wall feels a little bit obvious, and I'm surprised that people don't.
It just takes, like, there's a lot of things that need to adjust. Like, for example, like tech companies for a long time, they had policies where your, what they paid you would adjust depending on the city that you were in.
Right.
And now they're sort of realizing like, okay, we actually have to compete globally. We have to pay people like a California salary, no matter what time they're living. Yeah. And that's changing very slowly. Up until, I don't know if it was like a year ago or something, Facebook was like, we adjust your salary based on where you live. If you lie about where you live, like, we will like find you and like fire you. If you say that you're living in California, but you're actually living in Nebraska and you're pulling in like, you know, California wages, and then we see like a Longhorn pop behind you on Zoom, like there's going to be trouble, you know. But I think they reversed that policy. I think they're starting to, they have to compete. They have no choice.
Right.
Yeah. So it takes time. People need to figure it out. Like, people think like, oh, I'm going to go to a city and then I'm going to get a job. That's been the pattern for so long. I mean, that's what cities are. Cities are defined by a labor market. That's why people go to cities, both employers and employees. And like, it takes time for those habits and those cultural norms to sort of change.
Yeah.
I think there's just a lot of, there's a lot of distractions and diversions in a city too.
Yeah. Mm.
And especially if you're making a lot of money and you have a stable job, it's really easy to just get lost in San Francisco or Chicago or New York and just drink and eat and hang out with your friends and have a good time and not really think longer term or think about what else you might want outside of that.
Yeah. I wonder if that will get sort of less viable as inflation gets worse and prices start rising, and that feels less like tangible to people, you know, or less accessible to like quite as wide of a range of incomes as it has been in the past.
And as people get orange-pilled and as they get into Bitcoin.
Exactly. Right? Yeah.
Because,
and
then they're like, bringing it all back full circle because of the long-termism of Bitcoin.
They're like, I need a yard so that I can have a grill for all my beefsteaks.
Yeah, right. Right.
And where are you going to get the steak from? You know, you need cattle and all that.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm curious. So like what you've done sort of like traveling across America, kind of with like, you know, things that you're going to, but sounds like you really were sort of just like wandering a lot, a very indirect route. That's like one of my personal dreams, is to like eventually take a road trip and kind of just like figure out America. Mm. I talked to you about Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance when we were at the meetup, very influential book on me. Also, one of John Steinbeck's last books was like a... John Steinbeck, you know, wrote a lot. He's like a very Americana writer. And in his old age, when he sort of like knew he was dying soon, it was like 1960. And he realized that he like wasn't connected to what America was anymore, and that America was changing. And there was all this like chaos of the early 60s. And he was like, okay, I'm just going to get in a van and go drive around America and write a book about it, because I'm heralded as this like Americana figure, and I don't even know what America is anymore. Mm-hmm. And like that sort of trope, I just find so like I feel like that's something I really want to do in my life. And so I'm just curious, like, for you, you know, deciding to do this and just get on a Harley and like ride around America and go to Bitcoin meetups, like, what were the questions that you were trying to like answer, I guess, or what were the things that you wanted to know, and do you feel like you've answered them, and what are those answers?
Yeah, so one has to do with Bitcoin and one has to do with America. So I wanted to kind of soak in American culture again, because like I said, I've been out of the country since late 2019. So I missed all of COVID and all of the shit that went down during the last 2.5 years. And I watched a lot of it through Twitter. So I had a very weird and warped idea of what America could be.
Yeah, imagine being in like Southeast Asia, you know, like in eating like some pad thai, like just watching America like decompose on your phone. Like,
that's
what
exactly
the fuck
what
is going
I
on?
I wake up, I live next to a golf course, I hear people teeing off, I hear birds, there's light rain in the morning, I'm looking at palm trees, I'm eating breakfast, and then I pull up like police beating people in the streets and burning cars and stuff. And it was nuts, and it was all over the US. So I really didn't, and this goes to a lot of, through a lot of my life, I didn't know what to expect, and I didn't really expect anything. I just wanted to see what is America like now? What does it feel like to be here? And I got a pretty good answer for that. I have done some road trips across America, but not for this long and not for this many miles. And I got a sense that, for one, America is way more diverse than I thought it was, just in culturally. It really feels to me like multiple countries, more like a European Union. Yes, we all speak the same language. We all use the dollar. But other than that, the
what are the regions?
How does it break down?
There's kind of like a middle south, eastern south, Texas, the west kind of all felt similar, the west coast. And granted, I didn't go to the Pacific Northwest or really the north part of the states, and then the Midwest. And I didn't go to the east coast either. So I went to the south, the Midwest, the west, Texas, and California coast, pretty much.
Harley riding culture, you know?
Yeah, so it feels like Texas has its own kind of vibe. Then there's sort of like a deep south, which is geographically like the west part of the south.
Right, like Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana. Yeah.
Then like the Carolinas, once you get over the Smoky Mountains, it's kind of cut geographically. Like once you get over the Smoky Mountains, it feels a little bit different on the eastern side. People in the South are like super chatty, really friendly in a way that I was not used to living in New York and in Chicago. Like people in the Midwest, certainly they're very friendly, but it's kind of a quieter, more timid friendliness. In the South, people are like saying hi to you all the time, joking around. It's like, it felt kind of like Asia a little bit in that sense, which was strange. Midwest, like every time we had a meetup, there would always, at the end, I usually stayed till the end of a lot of meetups, and there was always a Midwest goodbye.
What's like a Midwest goodbye?
People keep talking and can't figure out how
to exit. To leave.
Yeah, once it's like four or five people, everyone just kind of stands around and looks at each other and like says a little thing, and then it's like, oh well, I guess.
I hear like it's whelp, and you slap your your thighs, and you go whelp. And then everybody just kind of gets it.
Exactly. It's like a, well, I guess I got to hit the road, you know, like, and then people kind of start moving, but then somebody will be like, oh, I forgot to tell you about this. And then it starts again. So you kind of got to break it and then stay far enough away that, that it exits. But really friendly, like down to earth people in the South. Then you get to the West and it's a little more, it's still friendly, but it's distant. Like people are much colder, more just do their own thing.
I mean, that's the most common thing that I hear, you know, when I meet people who know I'm from California, I talk to people about the difference between California and other places is like, yeah, it's very friendly, but it's very superficially friendly. Yeah. Everybody's friendly as a matter of course. It doesn't necessarily mean anything.
It is still an improvement I've found from the Northeast where like everyone's not friendly. Yeah. Like everyone's actively unfriendly.
Everybody's just aggro. Like, yeah, it's way better than that. Like, I mean, like, I was on the subway and like I accidentally like my foot must have brushed the in New York the foot of somebody behind me. She stamped on my heel. She just lifted her foot up and just on purpose stamped on my heel.
Fight for your
life. I was
life
like, all right,
ways.
Like this is New York. Like okay, I definitely prefer superficial politeness.
It is
that.
More efficient though. You know, it's
definitely no, it's not.
I found like Californians don't know how to like line up for things and do stuff like for how crowded this state is like Californians do not know how to like just do things quickly and be like in and out. There's a lot of people here. We got to do a lot of stuff. Like you guys can't merge on the highway. Sorry, you know, not to derail, but it's like
don't get me started on that driver.
It's insane. They,
who has
yeah,
the worst drivers?
Oh, California.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah.
But have you been to Miami?
Yeah.
Listen,
oh my God,
I mean,
Miami's peachy.
What are you talking about?
To California.
I thought I was going to die within 5 minutes of leaving the Miami.
So here's the difference.
East Coast, both have bad drivers. On the East Coast, they're aggressive. They're actually good drivers, but they're very aggressive. On the West Coast, they're just straight up bad drivers.
Interesting.
Like half attention on the road, weaving around at 80 miles an hour.
Uh-huh.
Just dumb.
I mean, they're, you know, they're pretty high, so.
Yeah, there's that stereotype.
Exactly, yeah.
I also think the weather might have something to do with it. There's never any inclement weather, so you don't have to worry about spinning out or.
Oh, yeah. Mm. When it rains here, like, people go insane. Yeah. Like, yeah, they're just like driving like 50 miles per hour on the highway, like.
I grew up in Chicago where, like, if you try to drive like this in September to May, you're just going to kill yourself.
It weeds them out. It's evolution.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
You know? Yeah, there's no selective pressure on Californians to be good drivers.
Yeah.
The Chicagoans, they just fucking die. The Chicagoans that drove like California, they're dead years ago in a ditch in winter.
It's funny that you like, just to think about how different the subcultures are in the United States, given how young the United States is as a country and how like the origin of people being where they are is most of them, you know, have not lived in that spot for very long. It's just crazy. Yeah. How much the culture is so like diverse and segmented and everything like that.
I think it has to do with how big the US is. If you have a big country where it's hard to get around, you have the chance to develop cultural diversity. This happens in languages, like with, if you have a country that is like a big flat plain, the languages and dialects will tend to be not very diverse because people can move from place to place. Everything can normalize. If you have a lot of, you know, valleys that are hard to cross and like jungles and stuff, the languages will be super diverse because they've all been able to grow in isolation and change in isolation and not merge together back with contact.
Right.
So with such a large country, it actually kind of makes sense to me that you'd have a lot of different sort of cultures like arising.
And they break at the mountain ranges too.
Yeah.
That's kind of where I see a lot of the changes. I've been reading a book about hill tribes in Asia and how that happens from mountain to mountain. Like you can see over there, but in your entire life, you've never been over there.
Right.
Because up until the advent of roads and radio, like up until the last 100
years, going through a mountain, a jungle valley, is hard, right? Like that's, even if it's
and
like a mile.
Forget it in rainy season.
Yeah,
forget like it's it.
It's
washed out.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, that book is all about like the flat plains are where the states developed. And I even feel it living in Asia, the emanating from the capital and from the flat part of the plains is the super, like I live in Thailand, so there you go, doxed it. The super Thai areas are the flat plains. As soon as you start hitting mountains, it gets way more diverse.
Mm.
And you can go into, like, drive up to a hill tribe, and they're like, sorry, I don't really speak Thai.
Yeah.
I really speak my local dialect. Because they still have these very localized cultures up in the mountains.
How does that relate to, like, Bitcoiners across the country? Do they engage with Bitcoin in a different way, depending on where they're from? Do they have different sets of interests, depending on where they're from?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It does differ a little bit, but I would say like the core things that I've noticed about Bitcoiners are not really location dependent, like low time preference, a belief in the proof of work, like sticking to your word, these kind of like honesty and truthfulness principles. They don't really have much. They have like local manifestations, but those are pretty strong. Other things are kind of just like culturally surface things like the Midwest goodbye and things. It doesn't feel like they affect Bitcoin all that much.
Yeah.
Locally, I definitely find like power prices.
Uh-huh.
Someone should make a map of power prices and interest in mining.
Mm-hmm.
Like I went to Indiana and everyone was talking about mining.
Right.
Yeah.
Had one mining rig or was playing with it. Then I find out they have 6 cent power everywhere.
Oh, like residential 6 cent power.
Just outside of Indianapolis,
oh, crazy.
20 minutes outside.
Wow.
You have 6 cent residential power.
Wow. For people who aren't sort of familiar with power prices, I mean, that's super cheap for any sort of, and we're talking about a residential connection. That's in California, you'd have to be like a major industrial consumer to get something like that.
Close
if
to
that. Yeah.
Yeah, you probably wouldn't even get close.
And like, I probably have like 20 cent power that like goes up depending on how much I use.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the crucial factor on what makes a miner profitable is like what's their power cost.
Right.
Yeah.
So certain things like that that are like structural to where you live, you see differences. I'm wondering because, you know, most of my like Bitcoiner community is Bay Area Bitcoiners. And I do feel like we're a little bit less like politically conservative or maybe libertarian, but it's left. It's the Bay Area.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, we're going to Austin like later this month. And I'm curious to see kind of the difference between like Austin Bitcoiners versus Bay Area Bitcoiners and mm-hmm. how, so I could see like, you know, maybe some political changes that are just the result of the culture of the state or the mm-hmm. city. And then, yeah, energy stuff makes sense as well. Yeah. But, you know, Bitcoin is like an internet phenomenon. So the reasons why it would emerge in an area would still probably be how online is, you know, how up to date is someone with what's going on in tech, internet, right. whatever mm-hmm. kind of things.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah. The political divide is an interesting one because I find when I get into those conversations with Bitcoiners, like around the country, most of them lean more conservative, to mm-hmm. be honest, except for like Bay Area, West Coast is a little bit more left. But when you get into solutions and like how do we move forward and progress from where we are now, they're more apolitical.
Yeah.
There's more of an understanding that it's there isn't much of a political solution out of right. where we are right now.
Yes.
Are they a little bit more like localism, like you do you, like we don't need to, I mean, I would assume that they're a little bit more tend not to think like, okay, we just need to sort of force everybody to do the same thing. We're going to have a grand political solution. That's like a one size fits all thing for this country.
Yeah. Which I think is why they tend to in this day and age swing conservative because most left policies today are more, let me change and pull the levers right. for you.
Right.
Yeah.
Whereas conservative is more like, let's yeah. let other yeah. people, with a few major exceptions.
I mean, a really good example of that is, you know, Roe v. Wade, right? Which the left is outraged over. And they're outraged that like different states can do different things. You know, not talking about the rightness or wrongness of that policy, but it is a case where the left wants their policy to go over the entire country. And they're very angry that they can't do that, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would say I lean more politically left in general, but my sort of pragmatic feeling about politics is that there's not really like much we can do to save it right now. And mm-hmm. so we kind of just need to, like, I feel like I'm a pragmatic yeah. anarchist, essentially,
yeah,
which
yeah.
is not conservative, but it does align more with like that side of the political spectrum in America, just right, because yeah. it's anti-government
right.
and the left is... Even though the left could be anti-government, they don't happen
current,
to be.
The whichever right or left, whoever gets into power, whoever is the political representatives of those groups who get into power becomes pro-establishment
mm-hmm.
because they have the reins of power.
Right.
Right. I mean, we kind of forget that in the like 80s and like 90s, people were talking about like evangelical censorship. Right. As being like a thing, like the sort of evangelical, like conservative Christian right, trying to push a lot of like social control and stuff like that. Right. And now those same groups, the ones that are in power are like, oh no, we need free speech. Like, you know, free speech is a policy for losers. Like once you start losing, then you really want free speech. So you don't lose harder.
Free speech is for losers.
It is. Yeah.
Like us.
Yeah. I mean, we're definitely losing.
Yeah. No, it makes sense to me that, I mean, obviously I understand why Bitcoiners are mostly conservative. It makes sense to me. I think I'm curious, like, you know, obviously when you were in Thailand, you were seeing not just Bitcoin, but everything in America through the lens of Twitter and media. And now you're kind of meeting Bitcoiners and seeing America more firsthand. What would you say... like the differences, like has it lived up to the Twitter expectation or how's it different?
Oh yeah. So the one way that, and the only way it's lived up to the Twitter expectation is when I really start engaging with someone on Twitter, like someone will, I'll comment a lot on their stuff or find it interesting or vice versa. There's a real interaction that's created there. And I've met a lot of people from Twitter in person on this trip.
Right.
Mm. And that's been an incredible benefit of that website. What I will say about the difference, though, is to me, it feels really easy for Twitter to turn into just like doom porn.
It's just for sure.
All the time.
Yeah.
And it gets very negative very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And I have some theories on why this happens, but in person, none of that exists.
Yeah.
Like in meetups, it's much more hopeful. It's much more spontaneous and exciting. And people are positive about the future and positive about themselves and everyone around them.
Yeah.
There's just much more positivity in person.
I think in person, you're incentivized more to find common ground and positive interaction than you are on Twitter. I feel
on
like Twitter,
Twitter
very
much
incentivizes.
People do on Twitter, you can't do in person. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd like to see them try.
Those shit libs or those, you know, fascists.
Yeah, totally. It's just, I mean, it sounds like it's, you know, optimistic.
I think that optimism, I mean, you know, comes from Bitcoin a little bit.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I think, I mean, I would be pretty full on doomer mode were it not for Bitcoin
now.
I mean, can you imagine current year without Bitcoin? Like, oh my God, like just take me out. Like, I'm done. You know, just shoot me in the head. Like, no Bitcoin. Like, oh my God, things look bad.
No, it's true. Bitcoin is like hope, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's why I wish a lot more of my like left leaning friends would get into it, because I think it would. I think a lot of people can identify the problems, or they can complain about the problems that are going on politically or in this country or whatever, but they don't necessarily have solutions or a path to the solution that they want.
Yeah.
And one thing that is like, that I've really started to understand is left and right are very much bundles of things.
Mm-hmm.
And when I meet Bitcoiners, they will say, I think today, because they're conservative and they will vote that way more often than not, mostly because of what you said about like who's in power and who's setting the rules and making the rules, and who are we afraid of like taking away rights of other people. But there are characteristics that you would look at and say, oh, that person is very left. You would think that person's very liberal. Like, for example, in Michigan, I met a homesteader who got involved with like Earthship homes and learned how to build Earthship homes. He's very interested in pollution and sustainability.
These are these sort of buried, partially buried homes, or
they're made out of
substantial
like,
amounts of earth in their construction.
It depends on where you build it, but yeah, like there's one guy in New Mexico that created this whole academy for how to build these, and his model is like really well fit to the desert. And the idea is you can grow all your own food, collect all the water you need, and all the electricity. With the house and solar panels on the house and like a windmill for the electricity. The roof collects the very little rain that you get into giant containers. And then the water's reused like four times over, and it fertilizes things, and your sewage goes into your food and all this stuff. So
sounds tasty.
You can like live on this.
It's called sustainability.
It's called sustainability. Yeah, get with it.
So that kind of idea, when you look at that, you think, oh, that's like
hippie left,
super
hippie
leftist.
Yeah, totally.
But this guy's a Bitcoiner, and I don't know how he votes, to be honest, but I wouldn't have thought this guy's conservative or a Bitcoiner, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's, I think when you talk about politics, you hear conservative more than liberal.
Yeah.
But when you look at people's actions and how they act, like, and you start unbundling liberal versus conservative, it's all over the map. People are interested in all sorts of things.
Definitely.
That fit into both.
And if you unbundle liberal and conservative, you get a lot of people on both sides who are interested in self-sufficiency for different sort of, you know, vibes of self-sufficiency, but self-sufficiency nonetheless, who are into like DIY and, you know, who are like anti-establishment, very strongly anti-establishment on both sides.
Yeah.
And those people, they're all going to get Bitcoin. They're just going to get it.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of a pre-selection on the, I think maybe we're just starting to see a little bit of a pre-selection on the right for being into Bitcoin just because the narrative told you to be. Like, I would say that's sort of like the rise of kind of like people like Jordan Peterson being into Bitcoin. It's just sort of like mood affiliation.
Yeah.
But I think that's a very recent phenomenon. I think before that, it took you sort of independently coming to the conclusion that Bitcoin was a good thing. And that required you to get outside of sort of like the mainstream FUD, or however you want to say it. And I think that pre-selection for Bitcoiners often end up being more open-minded and thoughtful and like independent, free-thinking types, because they sort of had to be in order to get into Bitcoin in the first place, right?
Yeah.
You have, and at first on this trip, I kind of thought you have to be really curious to get into Bitcoin. Now it's getting easier and easier, but to get really into it, you still need that curiosity, because you have to push. No one podcaster is going to give you, you know, you just listen to these 10 episodes and now you get it all.
Except well, how many podcasts?
Present how many excluded, of course.
You'll get the astrology.
Yeah, you'll get the tech, you know?
But like it's, and I've experienced this on multiple fronts with Bitcoin. It takes so long and so many different angles to understand just one piece of what's happening.
Mm. Yeah.
And then that opens up invariably another 10 yeah. rabbit holes yeah. that you can go down. So it just kind of pushes you down that path, you know, each piece of information that you encounter that's about Bitcoin.
Until you're at a point where you're like, I have to find a Bitcoin meetup because no one in my family will let yeah. me talk to yeah. them about this yeah. anymore.
It does make me wonder if like, you know, we could see an era of just sort of extreme politicization of Bitcoin where the left is anti-Bitcoin for, you know, environmental and sort of social justice concerns. And the right is pro-Bitcoin kind of because the left is against it.
Oil and gas is a big yeah. thing, I think, that draws the right to Bitcoin. Oil and that's and part of what I think yeah. you're seeing yeah. emerging is oil and gas yeah. people noticing that Bitcoin yeah. is a way to yeah. sort of promote that agenda.
Yeah. And like, I don't, I mean, obviously, like, it annoys me when I have to talk to people who are like, hey, isn't Bitcoin, like, bad for the environment? Because they heard some, like, talking head on MSNBC say something like that.
Yeah.
But it would almost annoy me even more if I had to deal with, like, MAGA hat Bitcoiners, you know? Like, you know, like, equally crazy.
Well, you're a Bay Area way. Baby. You're not used to that.
I can't hang.
They will step on your feet with steel-toed boots.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
This is not some little heel click.
Yeah, yeah. So I do think we're headed in that. I think that's something that we have to be prepared for is the politicization of yeah. Bitcoin, because I do think the bigger that Bitcoin gets, yeah. the more that we're headed in that direction. Like, as I said, right now, I feel like we're still in a state where being a Bitcoiner or being into mm-hmm. Bitcoin at all is something you had to sort of try to yeah. do. But yeah. in theory, that will become less so over time.
The one thing that could stop Bitcoin from really becoming politicized is that it benefits people. So, for example, like if things that really benefit people don't get as politicized because both sides are like, oh, we want this. You know, we want to use this.
Mm-hmm.
So that protects things from being politicized. I think Bitcoin is a little bit like that. If you can accept payments, if you can, you know, maybe pay a little less in taxes, you know, through entirely legal means, if you can get what you want, you can do what you want without censorship. People on the left will personally benefit from that. And that might stop them from becoming rabid anti-Bitcoiners and might stop it from becoming politicized.
Babe, we disagree on
this. Yeah. You don't think so?
This is just my disagreement with you about, I don't think that people act in their best interests. I think people act according to tribal affiliations more than, you know, like if Elizabeth uh-huh. Warren is telling you to hate Bitcoin, even if Bitcoin's good for you, oh. if you're a Warren stan,
this is good because Bitcoin. it really gets to a strong disagreement. Like, I think we've talked about this, yes. and we definitely do disagree about this.
Yeah, you think people behave rationally, and I think they do.
I don't think they behave rationally. I think that word, need to find a different word for it.
Mm-hmm.
They behave
based on incentives.
Maybe they behave. Yeah, it's complicated. Yeah. A lot of different incentives.
I'll let you workshop it a little bit.
Yeah, it needs
I don't know, where do you work. Fall on the spectrum of that one?
I think there's an element of Bitcoin that you have to be independent to pick it up and use it and learn how it works and use it to your benefit. I think mm-hmm. a lot of the benefits come from people learning on their own on how to use it.
Mm.
And there's a culture, I feel it all over America, of somebody else has to fix this problem. It's not my problem. It's like a culture of being a victim of the system that you're in. Not to say that people aren't right that they are victims, but in saying, well, then the system has to fix itself. Someone else has to do this because it's my turn to benefit from what everyone else has taken from me.
Mm-hmm.
And Bitcoin is the antithesis of that. It's I'm taking responsibility for myself.
Yep. Yep.
And I think a lot of people would, just because of that piece in their identity, will fight it to the death because they don't want that. They want somebody else to have fixed it for them because it's not their fault that they're in the situation that they're in.
Yeah. You can be a victim, and victim mentality still isn't the best strategy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes. No, 100%. I do think that's like what the whole meme of like good times create weak men create bad times, whatever that whole cycle is. I do think we're at that point in the cycle where whatever weak men have created bad times and then the bad times are creating good men, the restarting of that sort of like positive cycle. Yeah. But yeah, I agree. I think there's some people, I mean, I notice it like, yeah, as like a doomsday prepper talking to people who usually it's young people on the left, like sort of my peers, that actually agree with me totally on my assessment of what's going to happen. Like they're like, yeah, the world's ending. Like they're actually usually more doomy than I am in the sense of they're like, we're going to die, like because of climate change or whatever thing, you know, like they have this idea that like things are really, really bad and they're going to keep getting worse. Right. And, you know, I try to talk to them like, okay, well, what are you going to do about it? Like, if that's really what you think, that's really, you think the world is in that bad of a situation. And yes, that makes you a victim of it in a way, it makes all of us victims to that in a way, like, okay. And what's the next step? And I think a lot of people, maybe they haven't been pushed to that next step. And there's something that would, I don't know what causes that change in people to want to take on more personal responsibility.
They need to see a path to do it. Like, I think you are a handy, like, capable person.
Handy? With these nails?
Yeah. I mean, I saw your house, the location of which will remain anonymous. Yeah. But, like, no, like, you're handy. You're like a DIY kind of person.
That's true.
I think you have to, in order to not really, like, wallow in your, like, victim misery, you have to believe that you can do something about it.
Yeah.
And I think these people probably don't actually think that they can do anything about it.
Yeah.
I get into spats with people a lot about like watching the news, for instance.
Yeah.
Because to me, it feels like you're hearing about all these problems all over the world all the time, all this violence and struggles and shortages and all these things. And it just creates a sense of like, holy shit, everything is fucked.
Yeah.
And it's so big.
Yeah.
What am I going to do about it? But then you just shut down. You don't have any energy to.
And then if you look at these people's lives, they're great. They go outside, they go to a cafe, they go to Denny's, they meet their friends, but there's this like, you know, just doom tube, right? That they're just like sucking on.
Yeah.
Like, sucking the doom directly out of the tube.
A friend in Thailand that was like, after, the U.S. pulled out of Afghanistan, it was a whole shit show. She was like, did you hear about the U.S. pulling out and this happening and this and this? And is freaking out about it. And she's not even American. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, maybe I saw a headline about it, but what am I going to do about that?
Yeah. You know,
like, what are we getting in a tizzy because we're going to go out and do something? Or are we just getting all worked up and then, okay, we'll go out to lunch now and, you know, just live our normal lives.
Yes.
And it feels like people just, feed on that and then it sucks all their energy and then they don't do anything about it. So they don't think, okay, my, you know, food prices are going up and my salary is not going anywhere. Well, I'll just go have a beer and forget about it.
Yes. Yeah.
Just a lot of that falling into those cycles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe that is also partially why, you know, going back to what we first talked about with the difference between sort of the first tier city Bitcoin culture versus like second tier cities or smaller cities is the more that you're able to sort of distract yourself from, because I feel like Bitcoiners often have a very astute assessment of the situation and they've sort of, they might not be like always like checking the news, seeing like the updates, but it's like they kind of know enough that they need to know to sort of see like, okay, we got to make these changes and this is what I think should happen. And like they are educated on current events, but not in the sort of like addicted to every moment way. But I feel like, you know, in a city you are, it's, I don't know. I feel like that it's like a younger culture where media is like more a part of your life and there's more distractions to sort of like allow yourself to be desensitized and not process. If you feel that way, if you really think we're headed in that direction, it's like, okay, well, I'm never going to retire. I'm just going to go get a beer. Cities, like, you know?
Cities are also places where you are dependent on a large external systems.
Yeah.
Right? Like you take the subway, you work at a very large employer, you get all these like city services, right? And I think that breeds a mentality of like, oh, like all I can do if things are broken is try to ask somebody to fix it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because if your toilet breaks, you have no idea what's going on, how it works, and like not a single understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas people like live out in the country, they do they don't necessarily have to, but I think they do more of that.
Well, it's
type of thing.
There's so many reasons why you have to. I mean, like if the nearest person who can help you is like 15 minutes away or an hour away, you're just going to be like, okay, I guess just I have to figure out how to fix my toilet.
So much more convenient. Yeah. To go do it yourself. But exactly. In a city, it's like, well, it's someone else's problem. And I think people project that then into the larger political realms. Like, well, climate change is like, we just need to vote in the right person who will solve it.
Yeah.
I can just pay someone to do that, you know?
Right.
I can buy paper straws and save the environment.
Yeah.
Bitcoin does incentivize people to like, it gives them an avenue towards a positive way that they can like self-improve and like, improve their own lot, right? By like stacking sats. Like I do actually think, like it's like, this is so corny. But like I do actually think that like, that the, like if you have nothing but fiat, which is one, inflating, and two, if you say like, oh, like I should save my fiat, everybody goes, oh no, you shouldn't do that. It's going to lose value. It's going to lose, you know, in good times, like 2% a year, you need to be in the stock market, whatever, you need to do this like complicated thing. And it's like, oh no, you actually shouldn't pick stocks. There's a specific strategy where you buy like a mix of stock and bonds and like stock indices. And like, that's what you should do. And that's super abstract and in some ways like risky and in some ways weird and very complicated, right? And instead you say, no, this is a scarce asset. Just like get this scarce asset and try to get more of it, right? And like you can provide for your own future and you can take care of yourself that way. I think that's a big mindset, like possibly like a cultural shift.
And it is easy. Well, I guess it's easy and it's not easy because your point that like you kind of have to know what you're doing in order to buy Bitcoin and hold Bitcoin and have it is still accessible at many different like income levels, right? Like
absolutely.
you can buy
a fraction of a Bitcoin,
exactly,
as they say.
Yeah. So it is in some ways, it's like, I feel like what I try to focus on in my own sort of like assessment is what are the actual individual actions I can take to move the world in the way that I want to see it or change my community or change my lifestyle to like sort of bring about the changes that I want to see in the world. And I do think like stacking sats is like, it's like a relatively simple way
of
buying into a hopeful alternative.
And you can go ahead.
It totally changes your mentality.
Yeah.
Like, and it starts very slowly. Like I lived in New York when I started getting into Bitcoin. So I was relying on all those city services. I wasn't doing anything for myself. You know, I'm calling experts to go help me with everything and trusting them with that. But when I started buying Bitcoin, it's this very simple, oh, well, there's no one I can call to fix this. If this goes wrong, there's no support. Mm-hmm. I need to really learn how to use this.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started to find that, one, to be a really rewarding experience. I started to really understand how the protocol worked. I'm buying it. Then I'm trying to figure out what is this going to do in the world? How does it fit in the world? And realizing, learning more and more about this is a really fun experience. Learning how to handle this is really fun. Maybe doing that in other domains is also a really fun and rewarding experience.
Yeah, it's very fulfilling. Yeah.
Yeah, in a city, it's very easy to just, oh, well, I got to go have a drink. I don't want to learn how to fix my toilet. I don't want to go buy a plunger and go do that and go deal with the crowds. And out in the country, you kind of have to. But in a city, it's very easy to just have all of those services. Cooking is a huge one. I never had to cook because I just go out and go right outside and there's 10 restaurants right there that are always open. You don't have to really focus on those things. So you don't dive into them and learn which ones are rewarding for you or interesting for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be an aspect of it. Because I've definitely seen, I've met so many people and heard their stories of how they got deeper and deeper into more like healthy and sustainable practices for their life because they discovered Bitcoin or alongside their discovery of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Like people stopping drinking, going from alcoholic to not at all because they've been following Bitcoin and understanding it more and more and then thinking longer time preference and seeing me drinking every night is not helping me. I'm not getting out of the hole by drinking.
Mm-hmm.
I need to stop that and thinking, well, in a day, this is going to hurt, but in 5 days, in 5 months, in 5 years, it's going to be way.
Right. And that's how we feel when Bitcoin's at 20K. We're like, right now it hurts. But I'm curious about like your personal journey to becoming a Bitcoiner. I mean, you've talked a little bit about living in Manhattan and then moving to Thailand. It sounds like there are many ways in which you've sort of like reassessed your life and changed your life. What was your journey to Bitcoin? And do you feel like that was like a trigger of the rest of things or did it happen at a similar time or... Yeah.
It kind of happened all together, but I'll break it into sections. So I discovered Bitcoin, my earliest note was 2014 mm-hmm. when I had written down, I studied the history of technology in university. So,
oh, what kind of degree did you get?
It was liberal arts and science, technology, and society.
Huh, okay.
That's interesting. Cool.
Yeah, yeah. From Penn. So that degree, I was exposed to a lot of how society influences science. I think a lot of people think science comes out and the society changes, and it's very much an interplay constantly, yeah, along with technology kind of weaving together, changing things. And like every scientific revolution starts with someone who just gets hammered by the establishment and absolutely destroyed until they're right. And then, you know, the rest is history. And then the next generation forgets that that was ever not an orthodox thing to believe in.
I wish scientists understood the history of science more, because I find, sorry to interrupt your story, we talked about this also briefly at the meetup, but yeah, I wish scientists understood that sort of archetypal relationship between scientific discoveries and consciousness of like what we accept as true, because I feel like there is a lot of that that comes out that is immediately squashed. And maybe there's no way around that. Maybe that's just how it always works. But I feel like I'm always trying to reach individual scientists about that. And they don't have that sort of history context to understand that, I think. They just see science as this thing that exists outside of society, as this like objective way of examining things.
As separate. When in fact, they're very integrally tied.
100%.
I think that kind of primed me to understand, not to understand Bitcoin, but to be more interested in Bitcoin than other things.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought I wanted to go work in tech at Google or Facebook, or work on startups, social apps and things. And I was learning design and development and marketing and all sorts of things. And it kind of felt vapid to me. A lot of it felt pretty empty. And I got into this mode of like, technology is not helping us. It's hurting us.
Yeah.
People are addicted to their devices. Like, where can I go where this might not be the case? So I think that kind of primed me to better understand Bitcoin, and especially to separate eventually Bitcoin from the rest of crypto. So come 2016, 2017, I started reading more about Bitcoin, understanding how the system works, but I was looking at it as this like new type of computing system that can create scarcity in a digital world. And I just thought that was super interesting, and I couldn't stop reading about it really. And it wasn't until late 2017, I was living with four other people in a tiny New York apartment, and I wouldn't shut up about Bitcoin. I just kept talking about it because I was interested in how it works. And I'm like, why aren't you guys so interested
in this?
Like,
oh,
crazy
we all know
thing.
That.
I learned something new about mining or whatever, and I'm explaining it. And one of my roommates finally asked me, like, do you even own any? Like, why do you keep talking about it? So I thought, well, shit, I should probably put my money out. So I spent like almost all the money I had at the time on a single Bitcoin.
Oh, shit.
But that was September of 2017. So it never went down, which really like pumped me up. It's like, yes,
right.
I hit on something. I found something that's actually interesting. Other people are more interested in this. Then I had the fortune of weirdly reading the Tether. I think the first one I saw, like one of those Tether Truther papers.
The Bitfinext or whatever.
That do you know about this? So Tether is this US dollar stablecoin thing.
Right.
It's supposed to be backed by dollars in a bank account somewhere, but it's in some shady jurisdiction.
Right.
And so groups of people have put together theses about how Tether and Bitfinex, which spun out Tether, which is an exchange, has been used to pump Bitcoin. So they would show like, oh, all this Tether's printed, and that's when there was a big pump in Bitcoin over and over again. So I thought, whoa, this might be true. So I sold everything in January of 2018.
Whoa.
And got out at the top. So I tripled my money. But
nice.
Not that much for what I had at the time, but it was enough that I was like, I found something and that I'm really interested in, and it hit off perfectly. So I quit the tech job I had at the time, and I just told
this people, is all making sense. Hardcore Bitcoiner, bought at the bottom, sold at the top.
I've been reflecting recently that I have never been through a bear market.
Because
I watched it, but I didn't feel it.
I didn't have
any skin in the game.
So
over the course of 2018, I told people I'm into Bitcoin. I want to work in Bitcoin and crypto as well. So I was going to ETH conferences. I worked on fundraising for a mining farm where I had to model out. I'd never done a financial model in my life. Learned how to do that. did a financial model for like a 5 megawatt facility. And I really learned how proof of work works down to the metal. And then I started to think, okay, everything else in crypto is a scam unless it's proof of work, because this is the real innovation. This is how you get this decentralized property. Otherwise, you're dealing with a database from 1973. Like, this is simple, simple stuff that you can do on AWS. If it's not incredibly decentralized, then it will be chipped away until it's centralized. So I thought it has to be the most decentralized. I was still going to Ethereum stuff and interested in that. And it was when I went to Bitcoin 2019 where I realized, oh, these are my people. It's not crypto. Because I was going to these ETH conferences and meeting people and kind of like, these people don't get why this thing is valuable. And they're not focused on preserving what makes it valuable. They're talking about scalability and all this stuff on top of it. They're not talking about how do we defend this system from attack, which is like, without that, you don't have anything. And then when I went to the Bitcoin conference, that's all anyone was interested in. You know, that's the core of the matter. That's the really big conversation that you get into. So
I think I realized the big difference between Bitcoin and crypto is that, and other cryptocurrencies, is that Bitcoin is designed to withstand the state. And that is like an explicit goal of Bitcoin. That is what everybody has in mind, is like, we must resist nation state actors. Other cryptocurrencies, they don't think about it, and they probably can't resist nation state actors.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the final boss.
That's
like, who twists the arm of coercion of the corporations, who twists it of people, all the way down. It starts at the state. So if you can't survive the final boss, then you're going to go down at some point in time.
Yeah.
So once that started to click for me, then I was all in Bitcoin. I'm not really going to worry about too much else. And right after that, but for separate reasons, kind of, I moved to Thailand. I was just tired of living in New York City. I wanted something different. I, similar to what you were saying about living here and like not really finding people who are into what you were into, I was going out to bars and drinking and eating nice food, but that's not me. That's not what I'm interested in doing. I like that, but I want to do way more than that. I'm interested in way more than that. And I wasn't getting that in New York. And I kind of fought it for a long time because I thought, I'm in New York. There's millions of people here, some of the hardest working, brightest people. Isn't this where I should be? Why can't I find people who are interested in what I'm interested in? So I thought, you know what? It's something's not working out. I very spontaneously made the decision, I'm going to leave. And then I went through like 9 months of planning that out and went to Thailand, picked up, packed a bag and moved. And then getting some distance from American culture, learning more about like how difficult investments and money and banking and all these things that we take for granted in America are outside of America, really solidified it for me. Then I started to really understand, okay, Bitcoin is on many, many levels helping people.
It's more than, it's the solution to many problems.
That's
very interesting. Do you think you'll stay? Are you planning on heading back to Thailand?
Yeah, I'll be back there in probably 6 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah. Great. Still have a place there and everything.
Nice. I'm glad we caught you then.
This was perfect time.
Yeah,
this is good.
That's, I love your story. It's cool to see. It sounds like you had many sort of aha moments throughout the process and over many years. And it's crazy that you bought and then sold the top and then got back in still.
Accidentally timed it.
Yeah.
There was another big aha moment that I missed, which is right after I moved to Thailand, I went to a conference, another random thing, like found out about it a week before in Vietnam. And at that conference, I met Steve Barber, who runs Upstream Data, the mining company, and they do a lot of mining on oil and gas. And at that time, I was really interested in Bitcoin, but I was struggling. So this was beginning of 2020. I was still struggling with, other than number go up, why do people really want this thing? Is it really just greed? Mm. Or are there other reasons that people will want to use this? And I talked to Steve, and at that time, his answer to my question, I asked him, what do oil and gas people think of Bitcoin, like your customers that are mining? And he said, oh, they don't like it. They hate it because they're very aligned with finance. They understand what it is and what it represents. They don't want to touch it. They don't want to use it, but they have to mine because you just told them there's money on the table. Do you want to take it or not? And they have to take it. Mm-hmm. They can't not take that. If they're flaring gas and wasting that gas and they could be making money off it anyway, then they're going to make money off of it. Mm-hmm. And that's when it clicked on that front. Like, okay, there, that's a big set of powerful people that are deep into the infrastructure of the world.
Yeah.
That will adopt this, that need this.
Yeah.
To solve some problem.
Yeah.
And then it's not just buying it to get rich or to gamble or trade off of it.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you're sort of distinct. It's not like a speculative. Yeah. It's not like speculative greed. It's like they need it to make their business work.
It's speculative in the sense that, like, if Bitcoin went to zero, then it wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm.
But my understanding from Steve is, like, they're not, they don't even want to know that it's Bitcoin. They just want you to send them a check in fiat.
Mm-hmm.
That's here's what you earned on this machine.
Mm-hmm.
And once they understand that, they can't say no to it.
Right.
They have to.
Right. Yeah. It's that is one thing that kind of sets us up for politicization of Bitcoin, which is that as the buyers of oil and gas resources dry up, as, you know, people switch the mix of power to more to solar and wind, their buyers are going away. And well, they have this buyer in every market and every place of Bitcoin miners.
Mm-hmm.
And that could, I think overall it'll probably be good, but there's going to be some wailing and gnashing of teeth over that.
Oh, yeah. I think we definitely need to have, like, an in-depth conversation on the pod about oil and gas with someone who knows more.
We need to get two people who are just going to fight about it. Like, have some, like super, like left-wing, like peak oil kind of person. Mm. And then some, like, just petrodollar, like, guy in a cowboy hat, you know?
Yeah. And we could mediate.
Wildcat.
We could instigate.
Yeah,
that's really interesting, because, yeah, I often wonder about the pathway to adoption and what that will actually look like. And kind of going back to what you were saying about just people sort of realizing that it benefits them, I'm like, I'm not sure if that's going to be the thing to. I believe that that will work for hedge funds and finance people and certain people that understand, like, oh, number go up, that's great for me and my business, I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
But
or hedge funds make a market. You know, they don't even need it to go. They just need it to move a lot.
Yeah.
And they'll just scrape pennies all day.
Right. True. Yeah. So it's finding those sort of
those things where they
things where it's like, this will just happen. Yeah, I think.
And I think it's harder to understand coming from an American perspective, because our banking institutions and payments and money work fairly well, but in other parts of the world, that's not a given at all. So those other benefits of Bitcoin censorship resistance and hard supply cap, those start to have a bigger impact,
right?
And mean a lot more to someone that's in Africa or, you know, a small country in Asia or whatever.
Yeah, it's our financial privilege as Americans.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It totally is.
100%. Did we get through everything? Is there anything else we want to talk about?
I don't have anything else.
Yeah, I feel like that was pretty solid.
Yeah.
Sid, thank you so much for joining us.
Should we do the, like, where can people find you?
Yeah,
like,
right. Where,
yeah.
Yeah.
That's our duty as the podcast. Yeah. You want to shill something? Okay. Got some dick pills you want to sell?
Like, all right. Here's my list. And go down all the things I want to shill.
Find you on Twitter, right?
Yeah. What's so you can find me on Twitter at Captain Sid, SIDDH. Find me on Twitter there. The other things I will shill would be this ride that I did across the country. I did it with a couple companies that helped me kind of build a network as I was going. They're going to be producing content coming out of it. Biggest one is Swan Bitcoin, so they're going to be making, like, a docuseries about the trip.
Oh, no way.
Because I did interviews the whole way through.
Oh, awesome. That's really cool.
Shit.
Almost every meetup.
I'll watch the hell out of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they did the short segment you were talking about when I walked in, the hard money segment. They put that together. Their team's incredible.
Mm.
They're literally watching all the footage and tagging it, and then they're going to put it together, like, Vice style into these episodes about...
Cool.
We don't know what. I mean, we're trying to figure that out now.
Yeah.
So that's Swan. Unchained Capital is another one that does, like, security, Bitcoin security, and financial products. They helped me a ton with Texas, just putting together meetings in Texas and things, because that's, like, really their home ground. And then Bitcoin Magazine, which puts on Bitcoin Conference, incredible media company, and Upstream Data, which I mentioned earlier, the the mining company. They gave me money for gas specifically.
Oh, awesome. That's super cool. That's
told amazing. Me to burn more gas. Yeah, and the Harley eats gas. The last thing I would say is start a meetup.
Yeah.
I'll say that right to the camera. Start a meetup.
Yeah, yeah. It's not hard. You hear people all the time being like, oh, I wish there was a meetup in my area. It's not that hard. You just get some people and you can start small. Like people are like, oh, I need a space. No, you don't. Find a bar that has some tables and like go there with your like six friends and like get people going. Like it's easy.
Yeah. I don't know what it is. Like maybe people are looking at the big meetups and like, how do I do that? And you need a venue and tables and speakers and all this. You literally just need somewhere where you can meet.
Yeah.
If you got a field behind your house, just go there and set up a fire or something. Yeah. Like it doesn't have, it's not rocket science.
Yeah. And it's so worth it.
It's so great. Yeah. I love the Bay Area meetups.
I know. Yeah.
And every meetup organizer I've met, that's how they've done it. It's been super grassroots.
Mm-hmm.
And they started with like three or four people and people would come and go. The one thing I would say is like start with a core group. Don't just start with you. If it's just you, I found a lot of people will get one or two people every week and then it just fizzles out. But if you start with two or three people, then there's some chemistry there already and you're probably going to get together just to hang out anyway.
Yeah.
And then more people start
growing
onto that.
Right.
And I've been to meetups from 5 people to 100 people and pretty much everyone started like that. They just start very casual, very small and slow time preference. You can be patient.
Yeah.
You know, there's no rush.
Yeah.
Yes.
Start a meetup.
I love it.
Start a meetup. Yeah.
Well, great. Thank you so much, Sid.
Yeah, this is great.
Yeah. Great.
Cool.
Thanks for watching.
See you next time.
Bye.